the Exxon Valdez broke open in Prince William Sound in Alaska, dumping at least 11 million gallons of sludge all over the beaches of Alaska. I was, as soon as that ship hit, I knew, because I was an investigator, that I'd be called, and sure enough, I ended up in Alaska directing the investigation of fraud and racketeering charges against Exxon and its partners. And I was with the legal team that represented the natives who actually owned, you know, that it's not just empty wilderness. People live there, the Chugach natives, and they own that shoreline, which is covered with sludge. And I have to say, I just went back up there with Rick Rowley. In fact, we just put out a new film, Vultures and Vote Rustlers. Some of you have gotten it. It's not released yet, but some of you have gotten it by donating to KABU. And we just went up there recently. And I went to, you know, about 50 miles from where the ship hit, you know, Night Island, went up a little river with some biologists. Stuck my hand in the ground and pulled up gobs of oil from the Exxon Valdez. It's still
recently.
There.
I mean, you just did this.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's the other con. Let me tell you something. One of the things that they love to tell you about oil drilling and this stuff when they have a tanker breakup or the oil spill in the Gulf. And then I flew down to the Gulf and went to where they said the oil was all cleaned up. And there I did pick up tons of you know, gobs of oil, but I couldn't pick it all up. I mean, there were mats of oil that were as big as sofas.
Wow.
And these are, and this was after it was supposed to be all cleaned up.
Right.
You go down there right now to the Gulf Shores, to off Gulfport, Mississippi, and I see people picnicking on beaches. If they dug down 5 inches, they'd be hitting crude. You know, it's, people are sitting on toxic hydrocarbon. So, it's still there, and the con is still there, and that's what I wanted to talk about, you know, which is that, you know, we've been given this baloney. First of all, that nature, I mean, you know, the point of my going up there to film, me sticking my hands, you know, by the way, no, it's Exxon oil, because we brought biologists who do the chemical tagging, each has a certain chemical tag, and the view is, don't worry. Mother Nature's just a happy toilet. We can poop anything into her, and she just, you know, flushes it away.
It'd be fine.
It's not true. It's a wonderful fairy tale, and I saw our president splashing around in the Gulf. What we were told was the Gulf waters with his daughters. Actually, he's about 700 miles away in a protected lagoon in Florida. And he's splashing around saying everything's fine. And BP's running ads saying, come on down, the water's clean and clear. Well, just don't, if your kids go in the water, make sure they don't open their mouths or open their eyes. it's a grim joke. I mean, you know, that it is. The waters are still poisoned, and in Alaska, it's 25 years later. I mean, the seals that have returned, they're still going blind from the sheens that come out at the during storms, and birds are still dying, and even worse is that people are still dying from the cancers, and still have wrecked homes, wrecked lives. The natives I've worked with, they used to live off. This was their supermarket. This is what they ate, you know.
Right.
This is their food, and now they can't eat up those razor clams and the other stuff they used to do. So they're, you know.
Now, Greg, excuse me for a sec. The article that you wrote, you were talking about there was this fear that Exxon wouldn't pay the tribes for the destruction that took place in Alaska. And so there was this agreement that they weren't going to stop payment, and then they still didn't pay them for 25 years.
Yeah.
What you explained?
Well, what
that?
Happened, in fact, you're discussing an article I wrote for Truthdig, but you can also see it at gregpalast.com, is I did this investigation, did a six-volume investigation. investigation with all these inside documents and insider witnesses about this was not an accident, okay? And
because, I mean, I think there's a lot of...
That's one of the most important things. What we were told, and if you saw CNN last night, you would get the same old baloney story. A drunken skipper hits the reef. You know, that's the story. And you know, the corporations love this because it's all about human frailty. And they had Captain Hazelwood, the guy from the tanker, on. And once again, he apologized for being drunk. Hazelwood was not even at the helm. Yeah, he was drunk, and he should have been not drunk, and he should have been at the helm in charge, and it probably wouldn't have happened. And Exxon shouldn't have had a drunk running the ships. But at that time, most people, most of the captains, navigators got a snout on before they left Valdez. That's not, but that's not what happened. It's not true. It's not about like a drunk driver, some guy, you know, he's sloshed and he runs up a tanker on the reef.
Right.
That's not what happened. He was below decks. The reason why, by the way, the ship actually hit Bligh Reef, and the third mate ran into Bligh Reef, is that the Raycast radar system was off. The radar system was off. It was turned off because this is the old GPS. You know, this is GPS. They couldn't use the old $200 Garmin then. These were $2 million systems, the early GPSs, that required a lot of training, a lot of fixing and calibrating, and Exxon didn't want to spend the money. So on the maiden voyage a year earlier on the ship, they simply turned it off. They never trained anyone how to use it. So you had a guy running a super tanker
with no navigation
among the icebergs, and he is literally doing it like Christopher Columbus, dead reckoning, looking out the window, and he, you know, with a super tanker which he couldn't which he didn't know how to control, so I'm not going to let Exxon off the hook, but the real story, that's the real story about where Exxon's culpability, not the drunk. Yeah, it's true. Hazelwood, if the captain could have figured out what the heck was going on, but it's not about human frailty. It's about massive corporate fraud and cover-up. Exxon covered that up, but even more important, the real culprit that got away, the number one culprit in the Exxon Valdez disaster was not Exxon. And I'm not letting Exxon off the hook, but Exxon was dumb enough to have its name on the ship, which, by the way, it was changed to the Sea River Mediterranean, whatever that means. It sounds like a Club Med cruise ship, right? That's how. So they've gotten smart. They've taken their names off these ships, these oil companies, so when they crack up, they don't say, oh, the Exxon Valdez.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the Sea River Mediterranean? But the real culprit was British Petroleum. That's who is really responsible for the disaster in Alaska. BP, the people that then brought us the Deepwater Horizon disaster. You can ask me why.
Okay, why? Tell me why, Greg.
Yeah, okay. I'll tell you why. Because this shocks people at BP. Well, like I said, I headed the investigation. I spent 3 years on this. The reason is, you know, tankers run aground all the time, by the way. We just had a barge run aground in Galveston. But you didn't, all of the coastline of Texas has not been destroyed by this spill in Galveston.
Hmm.
And there's a good reason. If you look at those pictures, it's a real easy way to control an oil spill, okay? It just like you have a fire, you call out a fire department, they spritz it with hoses, and, you know, that's what you do. If you have an oil tanker spill or an oil rig blows out, it's really simple. You put a rubber on it and you suck. The way you do that is you put a rubber skirt around the stricken tanker or the oil rig or pipeline. You put a skirt around it in the water made out of rubber, and you know it can have various circles that can even go out several miles.
Right.
Because, you know, most oil goes to the surface, and you just gather it up, and then you suck it out with these sucker hoses called skimmers. You have a skimmer ship. Here's the horror show. The Exxon Valdez ran aground at Bligh Island. And if you look at the government papers, at Bligh Island, there was a containment ship with all this skimmers. There was all this oil spill equipment, these rubber skirts. You could put on the big rubber around the ship, and that would be that. And emergency crews, and even a pilot station, which would warn the ship not to smack up there. But what happened? Yeah, it was all there on paper. BP had filed papers with the government and sworn promise that there was all this equipment there, an emergency ship, etc. It should have been like someone setting a fire in front of a firehouse. It's right there. It literally cracked up right where the emergency equipment was supposed to be. But it was a lie, Joanne. It was a complete top-to-bottom fabrication, fraud, con job by British Petroleum. Now, why British Petroleum?
Right.
British Petroleum owns Alaska, and I don't say, right. They own it. 50%, 50.1%, and the numbers keep changing, about 50.1% of the oil in Alaska, 50% of the pipeline, 50% of the Port of Valdez and the shipping lanes are owned by British Petroleum, a consortium owned by British Petroleum. That put British Petroleum under law responsible for having these containment ships and the emergency equipment. They are responsible for preventing, containing, and cleaning up a spill, and that's what the damage was. Because you have crack-ups. Just because a ship cracks up doesn't mean that you have to slather poisonous junk all over coastline for 1,000 miles in Alaska and 600 miles in the Gulf.
And
that's the problem. They got away with this, and like you said, we had a deal. Here's the thing. BP and Exxon came to us. We had desperate Native Americans. We had the Chugach Indians on these islands in the middle of the Prince William Sound. They had no food because their food had just been killed and poisoned. They didn't have there's no like Walmart for them to go to.
Right.
They literally had no food. They had no livelihoods. They had now nothing. They were also did commercial fishing. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? Sell leaded and unleaded salmon?
Right.
So they were desperate. And BP said, here's what we'll do. First of all, you use the F word, fraud, in court, because we'd written up the material for civil indictment, the fraud racketeering.
Oh.
And they said, you use the F word, you'll never get a penny. And so our guys were desperate, mm-hmm. and we were told by Exxon, well, first of all, Exxon told us, you bring up the F word, we're not going to talk to you, and we can hold out for 20 years before we pay a dime. Now, I thought they were exaggerating. I thought, well, they could hold out 5 years, 6 years in
right.
court. In fact, they held out 22 years before they finally were ordered by the Supreme Court to pay something. 22 years, one-third of my clients, the natives, one-third have died.
Wow.
They died before they got a dime, 22 years. Now, British Petroleum got away with it because we were desperate. We needed some money right away for the clients, so we said, okay. It was agreed that, so British Petroleum said, oh, there's $125 million in an insurance account that our insurers will pay. Here, just take the insurance money. BP didn't pay one penny for the damage and fraud and horror that they created in Alaska. They just gave us the insurance fund. And that's not just for the natives. That was for every Alaskan, for the governments, for the cities, like the city of Cordova, whose mayor, by the way, committed suicide, leaving a suicide note saying, you know, I can't deal with BP and Exxon anymore, you know, seeing what they're doing
wow.
to the people in my town. He killed himself.
Wow.
And we had massive suicide epidemic up there after the spill because people were desperate. I mean, I agreed, and there was nothing we could do about this. But we had this. But I want people to know the real story, which is that BP is responsible because they're supposed to have the rubber boom. And in fact, the containment ship was up in Alaska in Valdez in a dry dock with the equipment under ice, right?
Right.
So, and these guys, and even after the spill, they told the state of Alaska, don't worry, the ship's on its way. Well, the ship wasn't on its way. It wasn't even loaded. It was locked in ice. And by time the ships got there, the emergency ship got there, basically like a fire truck.
Right.
It was like 13 hours later, the oil slick was, you know, bigger than Cuba, and there was no way to surround it. And here's the real thing that I got to tell you, Joanne. The horror show is that we saw it repeated 20 years later, excuse me, in the Gulf of Mexico. Once again, I'm looking at the Deepwater Horizon on fire. I'm watching this on TV. Remember, I did the prior investigation.
Right.
I'm watching this on TV, and I say, where's the skimmer ship? Where's the rubber boom? Same
right.
thing. Where's the rubber?
Right.
There was no reason for the Deepwater Horizon to destroy the coastline of the Gulf, but they did the same thing. They said that they had emergency ships. They said that they had the rubber skirts and boom.
Right.
They said they had the rubbers and the suckers, but
right.
they had none of it. And by time our president declared a national emergency, when the Navy moved in, the Navy, by the way, had 400 miles of rubber skirting ready to go, but that was supposed to be in the hands of BP.
Right.
By time Obama moved, there were even 400 miles of rubbers couldn't do a darn thing, except you put them across streams and stuff to make sure it didn't get in. But that oil just ran wild in the Gulf. So you had the same, because they got away with it in Alaska,
right.
they got away with it in the Gulf.
And so who is responsible for making sure that they're held accountable when they spill all into the Gulf for it? I mean, what government entity is supposedly providing oversight for BP and Exxon and other oil companies? I mean, isn't there a regulatory agency?
Yeah, good luck. I mean, first of all, in the guys that were supposed to regulate BP in the Gulf, for example, the guys supposed to regulate BP in the Gulf are the Minerals Management Service, MMS. And BP took care of them with cash and love. You literally, you know, I was investigating BP in the Caspian Sea in Azerbaijan. They used to provide prostitutes. BP used to provide prostitutes to the Azeri officials. Usually, fly them in Lord Brown's jet to London to get their action. And pay them millions in cash. The Minerals and Mining Service, those guys took short money, things like Super Bowl tickets and stuff to agree to look the other way. And instead of hiring hookers, the BP executives took care of the provided the services personally to the guys in MMS.
And so what's frightening is that we've just given, the Obama administration has just given BP more access to drill. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's right. The Obama administration has just released BP, said that they can go back and drill in the Gulf, and not only that, last week awarded them, this is this month, last week awarded BP a whole new track to drill right next to where the Deepwater Horizon went down. Everything's forgiven. And by the way, despite the fact that the head of BP exploration in the Gulf, a guy named David Rainey, is under criminal indictment, felony indictment, for obstruction of Congress, for lying to Congress. So what's the penalty? I mean, it's like, look, Joanne, if you dumped a bunch of oil all over your apartment, somewhere, you're renting an apartment, you dump a bunch of oil around it, you will not only be kicked out and lose your deposit and, be charged for the damage,
right?
But, they're not going to say, hey, listen, just no problems, move back in, we'll give you the apartment next door, so don't worry about it.
Right, right. Don't worry about what happened to your neighbors, right? Because, everything's forgiven, right? We'll just pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah, and like I say, it's still there. In fact, if you go, if you want to see, by the way, the film, you can download it. We haven't released it commercially yet, but my foundation has the copies. You can download it at gregpalast.com, and you'll see the oil on the beach in the Gulf, but even, like I said, it went up to Alaska. You'll see the oil up in Alaska. And again, BP is the hidden culprit. And in Alaska and in the Gulf, it's the same thing. These are not accidents, okay? These are the results of massive and continuing fraud. You have to understand that for years and years, BP was saying, oh, we have that equipment. They figured, who's going to know? And let me tell you something else. When I said there's no emergency crews out there, the Chugach natives, the people I worked with up in Alaska, they were at the Tetlik Island. They actually watched that tanker. It was near midnight. They actually watched that tanker come in towards the reef. They saw the tanker coming, and they are helpless to do anything about it. And here's what's really tragic. Here's the crazy thing. What really makes me sick is that, remember I said, you know, you can't have a fire truck without firemen.
Right.
The Tetlik natives and the natives of the Sound were the people that were hired to be the emergency crews in case of an accident. And they were trained. They had all the equipment. At Bly Island, they had right where the tanker hit, they had equipment there.
Right.
They had special ships there. They even were trained to drop out of helicopters and special Mustang suits into the ice water to set the boom, whatever was required.
Right.
They knew how to do it. But then BP, and that was part of the deal for BP to run, to build the pipeline and run the oil out of Valdez. But what happened was, once the oil started flowing, BP simply fired the natives. Why should they pay for them, right?
Right?
Why should we pay for firemen to sit around? Just like, you know, in any city, you have a lot of downtime waiting for the fire bell to ring.
Right.
They said, oh, well, we're not going to pay for these guys. They took away their equipment. They took away their boats. And then BP, because the law says they have to have these crews, BP literally made up phantom lists. It was like, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, kind of ghost ships with ghost crews, you know. Said ghost ships and ghost crews, and so when the ship hit, when the tanker actually ran aground, the natives were helpless. They didn't have the equipment. They didn't have nothing, and that's what, you know. That's, they lost everything. And here, and
so was that part of the contract, or was that just a promise that was made in Congress?
Two things. This is really sick. One, this was a promise made under oath to the U.S. Senate. And by the way, because the Senate vote was so tight that it was a tie, one of the rare tie votes in American history on whether to build that pipeline. And part of the promise on the record under oath was that there would be emergency crews and it would be manned by the natives who understand the local waters, which is very important. If you're
right.
going to save the waters, you have to know the waters.
That's
and
right.
You have to live out there, right?
Right.
And so they said, okay, we're going to have all the natives that are being hired. And so it was under oath. It was also put in the, and by the way, so it was still close, and it was Spiro Agnew, Vice President Spiro Agnew, that cast the deciding vote. And part of it was the sale of, we got these natives helping out. The natives owned the port of Valdez, owned the land under the port of Valdez.
Right.
And they gave it to the oil companies for $1. $1.
Whoa.
And the promise of the jobs, because they wanted the jobs. And so they gave up Valdez, which is worth $1 billion, in return for the jobs. You might say they were foolish, but, you know, they understood. If it's a battle between the political power of Exxon and British Petroleum versus some native tribes, forget it. So they knew that let's get what they can. So they said, we'll give it up. We'll give up the land for the jobs. And then they lost the jobs. But the thing is, when they lost the jobs, we lost Alaska.
Right.
Because there was no one there to clean up. This is British Petroleum. So because BP got away with it, they did the same thing in the Gulf. There was no rubber stuff. There was, you know, to contain the oil. There were no ships. There was nothing.
So again, there must be some congressional oversight committee that the moment that happened, that the jobs went away, weren't they supposed to step in and do something?
Oh, well, this is what another one you'll love. Yes, the state of Alaska has had a chief inspector for the oil shipping named Dan Lawn. And Inspector Lawn, and if you read my book, Vulture's Picnic, you'll get to meet Inspector Lawn. Inspector Lawn would like literally sit in the weeds outside the port of Valdez with binoculars and a long lens trying to say, where are the crews? He was hunting. I said, so he wrote a memo saying, I think that these crews don't exist. I think the equipment isn't there. Mm-hmm. And every time that there's supposed to be a surprise inspection, somehow they get, like, someone's giving them, like, 3 weeks' notice for the surprise inspection. And they come up with these, they have these, like, fake, he says, it's all fake crews. These people, they suddenly people appear from nowhere, like they get dock workers and stuff to pretend that they're the crew. And he says, this is all fake. He said, and so when British Petroleum found out that he had caught them, they had him fired. They had all this political power to have him fired. You know, this is one of the things that we had the, and by the way, and Bob Malone, who had been head of BP in Alaska, you know, when you talk about power, at the same time, he was also co-chair of the Bush for President Committee. I mean, these guys, so some inspector is not going to be able to stand up to these guys.
Right.
When I went, and they're brutal. When I went up to check on the oil in Alaska, I went with the head of the biology, and in the Gulf, I took with me the chairman of the biology department at the University of Alaska, who's the world's top oil spill expert. He said, absolutely, this is Exxon Valdez oil. It's this is Gulf oil, and he went down there. He even got a, you'll love this, even got a submarine to check for the, by submarine, check for the oil under the surface.
Smart.
And because he said the oil's still there in both places, the oil companies used their power and got him fired as head of the biology department. He was fired. What they did is they just took away the funding for the department. And so if you raise your voice, they chop you up. And then there was even some of BP's partners were nervous. Their shipping broker, a guy named Chuck Hamill, who was a fairly wealthy guy, he was their shipping broker. He was really nervous because he's their partner, right? So he was so nervous that he, when he saw what was going on in Alaska just before the Exxon Valdez hit, he said, oh, my God, there's an emergency. We're going to, what if there's a tanker spill? What if there's a disaster at the terminal?
Right.
So he took the Concorde to London. He got down to L.A., then took the Concorde to London to rush to BP headquarters to meet with the CEO. Their response was to hire some ex-CIA spooks and to break into Hamill's home, to tap his phone. They even tried to catch him in a honeypot. They kept throwing women at him. But he's one of these, one of these crazy guys who loves his wife, you know.
Strange.
But anyway, they tried everything. And then when he was meeting, he asked about congressional oversight. So he actually, in Washington, D.C., he met with Congressman George Miller of California, watching the pipeline disaster coming. This is before the Exxon Valdez struck, right?
Right.
And the BP had hired these ex-CIA guys, and they ran in a building in Washington to eavesdrop on Hamill. They ran one of those radio-controlled toy trucks through the air conditioning system with a microphone to eavesdrop on the congressman and this BP whistleblower. Now, the way we found out about it, you'll love this, when they ran the truck over, this also happens to be a secret listening post of the U.S. Navy SEALs. So a Navy SEAL team kicked in the door and arrested the BP guys. That's how we know about it.
Wow.
So BP, it's like, is there oversight? Yeah. But they either bribe you, provide you affection, paid affection, or they
take you out.
Threaten your career.
So, Greg, we have a caller on the line.
Yes.
For folks who are listening, I am talking with Greg Pallas, investigative reporter extraordinaire. We have a caller on the line who is Joe. Hello, Joe. Sorry for the delay. Welcome to K-Boot.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Greg, I have a comment and a question. The comment is this. I think when the Supreme Court reduced the award by 95%, I think for all practical purposes, that was the equivalent of an act of terrorism on the Supreme Court, and I'll tell you why. When an act of terrorism is committed, the number of people who are killed, the number of physical damage that occurs, whatever it is, the deaths and the damage is secondary. What is primary is the message that's being sent. What the Supreme Court wanted to do was to send a message which said, in effect, we don't care who we're going to hurt with this 95% reduction. Mm-hmm. We want you people to know that if you ever think you're going to win a conflict, you being the people, if you ever think you're going to win a conflict against corporate America, you can forget about that. You're dreaming, because we're put here, meaning the conservatives on the bench, we're put here to make sure that that never, ever happens. Right, so it was a shot across the bow to the American people saying, we will hurt you as much as we really can if you think you're going to march against corporate America. 95% reduction, I mean, it just infuriates me to even mm-hmm. think about it.
Mm-hmm.
My question is this, how would they justify it?
Let me explain to the public. Joe, let me just fill in people who are listening. By the way, this is Greg Palast, and Joe, I assume that you were a plaintiff in the trial. What happened is that Exxon dragged its feet and did not pay the judgment. There was a $5 billion judgment against Exxon by a jury. In fact, by a conservative Republican judge who said, yeah, that's cheap, $5 billion for Exxon.
Mm-hmm.
And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, took 22 years, and when it got to, by the time the Supreme Court got it, we had a new court under, you know, Supreme Corporation, Justice Roberts, a pro-corporate stooge, mm-hmm. there's no other way to put it, reduced the award from $5 billion to $500 million. So it cut it by 90%, and by the time you take away the cost, 90%, okay?
Right.
And this is for money. Now you say, well, it's still a lot of money. Well, you know what? We're talking about the governments, the natives, the landowners, the businesses that went under. You're talking about basically all of Alaska was mangled.
Right.
And they waited 20 years, and they take away 90% of the award. It was, to me, Joe was calling it corporate terrorism because it was sending a message. And I agree with the message, whether you call it terrorism or just, you know, corporatocracy or whatever you want to call it. It is a message saying, you know what, these guys are immune.
Right.
These guys are immune. And if you go up after them, you're going to wait 20 years. This is what I was telling you about my deal with BP to get some money to the natives. If you're going to you're going to wait 20 years, and then we're going to give you pennies on the dollar. So give up right now. Give up this minute in advance. We run it. We own it. We own the courts. We own the regulators. Anyone that we can't bribe or we will bully. This is a huge problem. Now, does that mean that we should despair? No, it's been kind of this, you know, the haves and have-nots. But now it's have always been at war. But the problem is that the haves have the instruments and power of right. the judiciary, of the president.
Exactly.
So, Joe, what's your question?
How would the... To play the devil's advocate for a second here, how would the Roberts Court justify that 90% reduction? I don't really think they ever made a justification to the American people, but at some point in time, they must have made even some kind of a weak effort to justify what they did.
Yeah, the justification to me was, obviously, since I was, you know, and I want to declare once again, I was on the legal team, so I, you know, I have an interest. It's not like I do this because I want to see how much money I can make. I obviously took on the Exxon Valdez case because I couldn't stand watching what was happening, especially when I uncovered those frauds. But the court's lame excuse was to limit the amount of punitive damages against the corporation to supposedly 3 times the damage caused. Now, the problem is that the court's idea of what the damage caused...
Right.
I mean, the damage
right.
was billion. Just the cleanup that we've paid for, the state has paid for, the government's paid for. The damage runs into billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars.
Right.
Not, you know, and how much do you want to put the value on the number of suicides and cancers right. and lives destroyed? You know, you do put numbers on that.
And people's food supply.
When I look at the amount of damage, which cannot be less than $5 billion.
Right.
That the judgment shouldn't have been $5 billion; it should have been $15 billion. And they said, "Oh well, by their calculation, damage is that it was just a little tiny accident, just some little right. oil." And one of the problems we've had is that because so much of that territory was wilderness, they say, "Well, this stuff isn't worth spam."
Right.
So
right.
who cares if it's oil? It's not worth anything.
Right.
Well, you know, is it really true that the 1,000 miles of coastline is is worthless? Is it really worthless? Right. You know, I mean, we can get to that discussion, but the truth is lives lost, cost of cleanup, the damage was enormous, but the court's excuse was that they were going to limit the punitive damages to 3 times actual damages, and they did it in a weird way. They said they simply took one of the small claims of fishermen, a partial claim of the fishermen, and said, oh, we'll triple that, that's it. Forget all the other damage. Right? And so the Supreme Court did have a, obviously they always write down some justification, but the justification, you know what, I got to tell you, when Joe was saying it's like terrorism, they're sending a signal, it was a signal. It was saying, look, we're obviously picking a number, you know, just pulling it out of our robe's backside, right?
Right.
Because we want you to know, we don't ever want to see a case like this again.
Right.
You don't come in here and tell us that you're going to hit Exxon for billions. You're just not going to do it. And BP was whistling by the courtroom because they didn't pay nothing. And in the meantime, as this judgment's coming down, we're about to have a major blowout in the Gulf. BP, once again, does the same thing. They're not prepared. They promise equipment that's not there. I had kind of a sick laugh picking up the New York Times recently. They just had full-page ads, probably have them out there in Oregon, too. Full-page ads by the oil companies in the Gulf that we have. Look at all the equipment we have in case of another blowout in the Gulf. Well, wait, guys, that was the equipment that you promised in writing to the U.S. government.
Right.
Under oath, that you said would be there before the Deepwater Horizon explosion. So why are you telling us you have just put this stuff out? Isn't that a confession of criminal activity?
Right.
Oh, it's like, this is what they get away with. But anyway, like I say, if you go to gregpalace.com, you can actually see this stuff on Vultures and Vote Rustlers. And if you...
And so I do have...
Vultures Picnic has that, too.
I do have your website on both my Facebook page as well as on the KBOO website. So for more information, we're telling folks to go to those sites and get more info. But we have several more callers on the line.
Yes.
Hello, Thomas. Welcome to KBOO.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
And Mr. Palace, it's an honor. I'm a longtime follower and admirer of your important work. I just
Thank
have
you.
one comment question. We hear so much in the MSNBC and NBR, and we hear discussions and hand-wringing in the establishment liberal about the role of the Koch brothers and in promoting fossil fuel above interests of the climate and environment, and we see tons of books that were written about the so-called Bush Jr. oil presidency and all of in-depth analysis of the inherent corruption in how the energy policy was carried out. My question is this. You know, we see that in a Democratic Party, the Progressive Caucus is the largest caucus in Congress. There's huge potential power. And, of course, the Democratic voters have been polled to death. The American people are probably the most polled people on the planet. Mm-hmm. So the head of the Democratic Party, the grand poobahs in the presidency, they know exactly what the sentiment of the electorate is and the broad public support against these energy policies and the interests of the oil companies. And yet we see time and time again our president ready and willing to play his eager role as essentially as a PR marionette for the fossil fuel cartel.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, I would argue that you can look and see with this outrageous now reapproval of BP for a next round of dirty drilling, and you see an oil policy that's almost indistinguishable from Sarah Palin's drill baby drill policy.
That's true.
And then not only that, but apparently an interest to enter the Arctic now, and also the complete willingness of the Obama administration to play key roles in scuttling the Copenhagen Climate Accord, et cetera. And somehow, you know, we see the establishment liberals and hereditary Democrats are failing to see what's right in front of their eyes. And what my question is this.
Let me fill that in. You raise a very good point. Like, everyone knows that the Bush presidency with Bush and Cheney and Bush Sr. before him, which is Bush Sr. was president when the Exxon Valdez hit. His attorney general meant to prosecute, who was supposed to prosecute Exxon, was Thornburg, Exxon's attorney, who'd been Exxon's attorney. And but you know, we can talk about the oilocracy under the Bushes, but you're bringing up something very important. So now we haven't. So people voted them out. So how come things haven't changed?
Right.
What's the deal with Obama, the drone ranger there? What's happened? And then you have to get into the specifics, which is, you know, the Democrat, he just passed away. Bob Strauss has been the head of the Democratic Party, the most powerful guy in the party. He was counsel to the Koch brothers. Okay, let's not forget that. The Democratic Leadership Council, which created Bill Clinton, was founded with money by the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers are not Republicans. If you read Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, you'll get some of this information. They're Kochians. They're
right.
Not Republicans or Democrats.
They don't care, right?
And in the case of Obama, who owns BP? It's J.P. Morgan, which is headed by Jamie Dimon, the guy who is Obama's, as he calls him. Obama himself says, is my favorite banker. There's no sense us giving billions of dollars to J.P. Morgan to bail them out if we're going to take it away by sinking their oil company. So you have to understand these more subtle, people have to look at the money, follow the money connections. And for example, if you read my book Vulture's Picnic, you see I go up to the Arctic Circle at the request of the leader of the Eskimo, Chief Etok, and I was up in the Arctic Circle, and he's going berserk because British Petroleum and Royal Dutch Shell, which is British Dutch and American, of course, are drilling in right off the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. Now, George Bush, frankly, would have never gotten away with it. Bush wanted to drill in the refuge. Well, there's only one thing worse than drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, and that's drilling in the waters right off the refuge, because, if you know, an oil spill in the refuge is terrible, but you can contain it. It's on land. Mm-hmm. An oil spill in the Arctic Sea can spread under the ice cap to Norway, and so Chief Etok was going crazy. Obama has just authorized this drilling in the Arctic Sea above the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. I was right there. And he says, look, we don't hunt whale, you know, because it's some type of, you know, cultural theater. This whales to us are lunch. And they don't like swimming in hydrocarbon. You know, they don't swim in oil. You may get tuna in oil when you go to in a can in the store, but believe me, tuna do not like to swim in oil, okay?
unless you chop
them up first in the can. And so there, you have to understand, Obama's gotten away with stuff that Bush could never have dreamed of. Was dreaming of drilling up there, couldn't get away with it. But Obama, he puts on his little green routine and cries about the baby seals or whatever, but he'll allow drilling where Bush could never get away with it. If Bush said that BP could go back and drill in the Gulf, we'd be going crazy.
Yes, we
MSD,
would.
You talk about MSNBC. You do not see Greg Palast on MSNBC, because I call it MSDNC. Because I will not sit there. You know, I haven't gone on MSDNC and talk with Rachel Maddow about how, Obama smells like raspberries. It's like the problem is that if I'm doing investigative reporting and I find problems, I can't be partisan. Yes, we had Republican governments under George Bush Sr., which let the Exxon Valdez go berserk. But under Obama, you haven't seen, you've seen a change of rhetoric, but not a major change in policy. In fact, in some ways, as some people in the environmental movement and even I work a lot with the great environmental lawyer, Bobby Kennedy. And, you know, some of the things are worse than any Republican could ever dream of getting away with.
It is absolutely true.
That's a big, big problem.
And, you know, I agree with you, Greg. I also agree that, you know, we've got this really schizophrenic kind of personality that if a Democrat does it, we're not as outraged as we are if a Republican does it, which is pretty ludicrous.
Well, the thing is that when you deal with something like what I call MSDNC, you're stuck with the fact that, you know, oh, you can't say anything that would undermine, give ammunition to the Republicans. Well, I'm not here to load anyone's political guns one way or the other.
Right.
And that's what's happened. That's one of the things that's destroyed reporting in America. It's you have to pick... you have to pick sides. It's like sports, your skins or shirts.
Right.
You know, and it's,
so, Greg, we have one more caller on the line, and I want to get that caller in, but I also want to want you to give us some hope before this hour is up. It's like you've depressed me to no end, but I want to leave with some hope. So our caller is Garrett. Hello, Garrett. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi. I just had an idea that I'm pretty sure will actually work. I know that they've been able to take cats and splice a gene into them that makes them glow in the dark. You can see some pictures of that on the internet. Well, oyster mushroom eats oil, and it leaves no trace of it behind. I'm pretty sure someone could actually splice part of that into algae and release it into the ocean so that it could oil.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the question. We're getting short on time. Give Greg a chance to answer.
Yes, actually, that's called hydrophilic. There is such a thing. It's hydrophilic, which means, hydrocarbonphilic algae, which means that the algae which loves to eat oil. And they sprayed a lot of this stuff, it's called bioremediation, on those beaches in Alaska. But the problem is you end up with the bioremediation stuff staying there, and some of that is itself dangerous and poisonous, and it doesn't eat up all the oil. Or you have the situation in the Gulf where we had, hydrocarbonphilic algal blooms, algae, eating up the oil from the BP spill, and then they sucked all the oxygen out of the water, and you have basically fishless square miles of the Gulf of Mexico now because, believe it or not, fish were drowning in the ocean because there was no oxygen left. So, you know, while the answer is we got to stop doing it. If we can't keep, like I say, at the beginning of the program, this is Greg Palast, if you heard me at the beginning, nature is not a toilet that just simply can be flushed clean. You know, you just pull the trigger. And it would be nice. Nature does have ways of balancing itself, like algae and oysters and other things that will eat the oil. But what we're doing is we're now creating new types of contamination which don't completely work, and then we've got a whole new set of contaminants in the water. Just like we loved, we had this great stuff called dispersant, and, you know, the law of Newton's law of thermodynamics kind of doesn't say that oil can, you can't make oil disappear. It doesn't really disperse. It sinks to the bottom. So now we have areas of Alaska and the Gulf which are paved like, you know, like a freeway, because the stuff sinks. So the corrects it creates is as damaging as the oil. So every time we try to come up with a kind of a wonderful fix, you know, biological stuff or chemical stuff, it's just letting us pretend for a couple more years that we have a way to save ourselves from the oil scourge. But to me, the biggest scourge of the oil is the pollution of the political system. When you can threaten regulators or bribe them, when you can buy off Congress, when you can eat, you know, when you can wiretap a congressman, shades of NSA, to threaten them, this is what's dangerous. But now let me get to a bit of hope by telling you a story, Joanne.
Thank you.
Which doesn't sound like hope, because today is the 50th anniversary. A lot of people in Oregon will remember this if you're old enough. I won't say if I am, but I am. I do remember. Is the Great Earthquake of 1964. Today is the 50th anniversary of the Great Earthquake of 64, which relates directly to our story in this way. The Great Earthquake hit. The word went out up and down the west of the beaches because tsunamis are going to hit all along the coast. The worst will be in Alaska. But no one thought to radio the Chugach natives in the islands of the Prince William Sound. And the village of Chiniga was hit with a 90-foot wall of water. Every single house, every single stilt house in that native village was washed out to sea, including one-third of the residents. And Father Nicholas, the chief of the village, he was running his. He understood there might be a tsunami because the water first disappears and then it comes back. So you know a tsunami's coming. They had a few minutes of notice because the water disappeared. He ran his four daughters up a hill. He saw this 90-foot wave, this 9-story wave coming at them. So he just grabbed the two next to him. And he grabbed the two next to him and ran up the hill, and the other two were washed out to sea. The natives, when they found them 3 days later, were dispersed throughout Alaska, and he kept going every year back to Knight Island to say, we are going to rebuild this village. And everyone said, you can't do that, until 20 years later, stick by stick, 22 years later, he had rebuilt the village. And but they moved it to a place where it would be safe from a tsunami a few miles away, the New Chinega. On the 25th anniversary of, it was Good Friday, on the 25th anniversary of the earthquake, they were commemorating, they were finally commemorating their new church and their new village with the survivors when they got hit with another tsunami, because that was the day that the Exxon Valdez broke open. So the 25th anniversary of the earthquake that destroyed their village.
Wow.
The village was again destroyed, this time hit with a wave of oil, all their fishing grounds. And I remember I was up there with Paul Kompkoff, the surviving member of the family, and he said, you know, he asked the president of Exxon, who showed up for a, you know, for a TV, for, you know, some public PR stunt with the natives. He asked Yerossi, the president of Exxon, so what are my parents' bones covered with oil? And they said, well, we'll get them. And they ran tractors all over the whole thing, digging up the oil and the bones and everything else. I said, I promised you a story of hope.
Yes.
So they rebuilt, and then after the earthquake, and it was destroyed by oil. And now they have rebuilt again. And they have now, and they, you know, Exxon wouldn't pay them for 22 years. But they rebuilt, and they created these industries. Yes, they're not. They don't have a chance to do seal hunting anymore. But you know, they can't. You know, they're not museum people,
right.
And they've set up businesses which they run by internet, and they have a $1 billion corporation running out of that village.
Wow!
And they're happy because they still, by the way, do seal hunting, and one whale they catch a year, and they say this allows us now to let our kids, so they don't have to, like, move to Portland, no offense.
Right.
They can
then
actually live up there because they have the funds and the ability to work by internet, and then they could take planes in the middle of winter and get the heck out.
You know what that music means, Greg? That means we have run out of time. Thank you so, so much for being here with us today. We always appreciate hearing from you. We've been talking to Greg Palace. You can go to my website and Facebook page and go to gregpalace.com. I'm Joanne Hardesty. See you next week, same time, same place, same station. Have a great day. Thanks, Steve, for all your work. Bye.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that glitter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light, hey. Stand up for your right. Come on, get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Most people think great God will come from the sky, take away everything, and make everybody feel high.
And good morning from the Mighty Boo. KBOO Portland is what you're listening to. 9 o'clock on your Thursday morning. And in about a half hour from now at 9:30 on A Deeper Look, the guest is Julia Angwin, author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll go straight to Flashpoints. We'll hear more from journalist Greg Palast about on the role of BP in the Exxon Valdez oil tanker disaster. disaster 25 years ago. Also, a killing in San Francisco sparks community outrage. And we'll hear about the play Placas, the Most Dangerous Tattoo, about a former Salvadorian gang member trying to put his life back together. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews author Helen Oyeyemi about her new novel, Boy, Snow, Bird. And at 11:30 on the film show, the guests are Vivian Haar, the 10-year-old anti-slavery activist at the heart of the documentary Stand With Me, and Student Academy Awards coordinator Thomas Phillipson and filmmaker Andy Chandler, who will be telling us about the upcoming Filmed by Bike Festival. That's all coming up this morning on KBOO. Coming up next, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. Stay tuned.
Listen to The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of each month at 11:30 a.m. The Film Show features news and interviews about the local and independent film scene. That's The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of the month at 11:30 a.m., only on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. It's 9:03 a.m. in Pacific. But you'll have to check the clock again because it seems it must be time already to begin softening up the U.S. public's heads for war. And I'm not just talking about Crimea. War criminals Rumsfeld and Cheney may still be more or less in hiding, but that isn't preventing them from showing their smiling faces on public media. Well, almost public media. Dick Cheney just got through with a speech this morning at American University in D.C. And since I see no news about torches or mobs in the newsreel, I presume only the enthusiastic imperialist wannabes at that sad institution were invited. What, you didn't hear about the upcoming speech? Funny that. A university publication gushed, "This is an exciting pull for AU. Cheney's insight, experience, and knowledge are unparalleled," reads the announcement. And it says, "I couldn't agree more. From serving as White House Chief of Staff in the aftermath of Watergate to manning the vice presidency on 9/11, Cheney has dedicated his life to serving the U.S. government and private sector to the best of his ability. Now he can share his unlimited amount of stories with students interested in pursuing a job in politics," end quote. You can't make this kind of stuff up. If someone, say, a recuperating Medea Benjamin, were to pop up and say unmentionable things like WTC-7 demolition or massive aerial war games, you can bet she'd have been hustled out with handcuffs and a sea of frowny, frowny faces. And I rather doubt the topics covered by Vice Bush Monster had anything to do with the right to a free education. Most of the kids at American University are well out of that class, having paid for their education by the cruel fate of replacing their childhood memories with a series of indifferent nannies topped off with an expensive convertible. They'll never know love, but at least they get to rule us. Now, I say I do counter-propaganda, so it's time to take on NPR, because the P in NPR stands for propaganda. In NPR's coverage of the protests in Venezuela, it is apparently taboo to mention that the current government in Venezuela was elected in a free and fair contest, as certified by none other than former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, nor will NPR mention that the protests are being run by the same people who tried and failed to impose a U.S. puppet regime over Chavez in 2002. Here's what was said at the end of one such broadcast last week after running an interview with one protester who reluctantly conceded that street fights are getting nowhere, quote, but other parts of the opposition feel street protests are the only way forward. They cite the lock that the government party has on power and on the media. According to Venezuela's constitution, Maduro needs to go through at least half his term before there can be a referendum for him to step down. But they say he needs to go now. That faction is headed by jailed Leopoldo Lopez and the legislator Maria Corina Machado. NPR spoke to her after a rally in Caracas, and then it has audio of Machado speaking. And Garcia Navarro translates, "When you have a democratic country, the people can ask for a change of government," she says, "as stipulated by the Constitution. But when it's a dictatorship like we have here, what we need is organization and public pressure to enact change." That opposition in Venezuela has a long history of divisions, but the difference of opinion is now poisoning the wells further. One activist told me that what is happening behind the opposition scenes is a civil war, and far from helping the protests expand, he said, it may be what does them in. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, in quote. And Lourdes Garcia Navarro is the go-to reporter for NPR when it's time for a fresh pile of steaming U.S. propaganda about Venezuela. Here's an example of her latest work on the U.S. dollar rate crisis, maintained by none other than predatory practices of U.S. banks, of course. Quote, "The exchange rate is just one example of the economic crisis that has prompted weeks of unrest in Venezuela. Many basic goods have been in short supply, and inflation has been running more than 50% under President Nicolas Maduro, who champions a socialist economy, as did his predecessor, the late Hugo Chavez," end quote. Did you get that, huh? Socialist policies. That's the takeaway. And that's what the American public takes away. That portion of the American public that listens to NPR News and feels that they're getting the long-form, balanced journalism that one might expect in a fantasy world. But don't expect to be on the guest list at the next surprise Cheney speech if you didn't get the message. The BBC and the New York Times have been enthusiastically supporting the would-be new coup, which is why when pro-Maduro activists get decapitated by our freedom-fighting pro-U.S. protesters, their deaths get blurred into 30 dead in the protests, giving you the impression that all the deaths are due to the evil machinations of Stalin. I mean, Chavez. I mean,